And then the first thing I have to do is read you this statement about what I'm doing. Oh, actually, could you get you the... Actually, I had it on yesterday. I think it goes better. Try that on. Just put on your shirt there.
It's just a good place.
That's great, yeah. Okay, so I have to say, the key objective of this interview is to serve as a research tool to document memories of the American chestnut in the southern Appalachian region. Information obtained in these interviews will be retained and made available for further use in efforts to promote a better understanding of the role of American chestnut in Appalachian culture. So then I say, have you signed the participant identification and release agreements?
I have.
Okay, great. So I like to start. Will you just tell me your name, where you're from, just like personal, or how old you are, just kind of like the basics of who you are. Okay.
My name is David Patterson. I live in Rising Fawn, Georgia, in the Rising Fawn mailing area. Actually, I live on Lookout Mountain in the New Salem community on a small farm that my grandfather bought in 1955, and then we purchased it from him before he died. And I'm 58 years old, and the first time I heard about the chestnut tree, I was probably 16, 17 years old. I was riding a school bus on Lookout Mountain to visit my grandparents, and one of the other fellows on the bus offered me a chestnut. And I still remember how sweet and delicious it tasted. And when I got to my grandfather's, I told him what had happened, and then he started telling me stories about his childhood, because he was born in 1904 and was grown before the chestnuts really started dying out in this area.
Great. So the first, you can just go ahead with any of the stories that you have that you want to share.
Okay. Well, let's just start with my grandfather. He's my first contact. As I said, I had the chestnut, went home and told him about it. And he actually went out, took me out and showed me a small chestnut tree that had bloomed that year. But it died the next year, and he watched it, and we still have chestnut sprouts that come up on our place. And several years ago, when William Rowell and I met, I told him I had chestnut sprouts on our place, and he came out and brought several people with him, and they dug sprouts and took them to Opryland and put a display up there with brochures to tell people about the story of the American chestnut tree. But anyway, back to my grandfather, when I told him about the chestnut, he told me about growing up in a place called Johnson's Crook, which is just at the foot of Lookout Mountain near Rising Fawn, far back in the country. And he said that everyone back then had pigs. And in the fall, when the chestnuts were ripe, everyone turned their pigs out into the woods. They put a mark on their ear or somehow so everyone would know whose pigs were whose. And they would eat so many chestnuts that they'd get so fat that they could hardly walk. And he said, back then, you didn't build fences to keep the hogs in. You built a fence around your garden or your yard to keep the hogs out. Mm-hmm. And the cows as well, which I'd never heard of before.
Yeah,
I have seen pictures of them since he told me that. And he told me about going out and gathering chestnuts, and they gathered them in flour sacks. Mm-hmm. And they would use them, and they would eat them, and then they would sell them. And a lot of his neighbors would make extra income selling chestnuts in the fall. Even with the pigs eating all they could eat, there were just so many of them. And then a few years after that, he told me that he had found an old chestnut tree that had fallen in the woods that was still, it hadn't rotted, because chestnut wood is very rot resistant. So he said, he was up in his 70s then. He said, I want you to go with me and we'll get parts of it, and I'm going to build a mailbox stand. So he did. This was back in the 70s, I guess. And I went over with him, and we cut pieces of it up and brought it out of the woods. And he built the stand for his mailbox out of the old chestnut log pieces that we pulled out of the woods. And they stayed there for years and years until someone ran over the mailbox and splintered it. So we had to put something else up. But those are some of my early Chestnut memories. The next real contact I had with chestnuts came probably 10, 15 years ago. I read an article, and I think it was National Geographic, that had the story of the American chestnut tree. And at the end of the article, it talked a little bit about the American Chestnut Foundation and told about its attempts to restore the American chestnut tree. So I called the American Chestnut Foundation, I tracked them down and called them, and asked them if they knew anyone in the Chattanooga, Tennessee area that was interested in it. And they said, yes, we do have someone. His name was William Rowell. And so I looked Mr. Rowell up in the phone book and called him and told him about reading the article in National Geographic and told him I was interested because of my grandfather's connection to the chestnut trees. And he immediately said, let's get together, and came and told me what he wanted to do. And one of the things that he wanted to do was to get someone in here to work on restoring the American chestnut tree. And so I basically was just his gopher. I did whatever he told me to do. And he said he had a guy that he was looking at. His name was Hill Craddock, and he wanted to get him in here to teach at UTC. And he was trying to get the funding together to have a chair so that he would teach, but his main responsibilities would be to help with the restoration and research the chestnut blight, and to help restore chestnut
so
tree.
Neat. It's unique. It seems. I wonder how many faculty positions are set up for that kind of reason.
I don't know, I don't know if Mr. Rowell contributed money to that chair or not, but I do know that I think it's called the Davenport chair.
I think so.
And he was able to get the Davenports, and I think what's the name of the foundation over in St. Elmo?
Not Lyndhurst.
Lyndhurst Foundation. He got them to contribute some money. But anyway, he got this chair established. I think it was called the Davenport chair, and got UTC. I don't know how he finagled that, but he got them to hire Hill Craddock, and he came and began teaching. And Mr. Rowell had been a business. He was retired. He was in his, I think he was in his early 70s at the time. And he had a lot of connections with the business community. And one of his friends was a guy named Summerfield Johnston, I think it is, who was a big wheel in the Coca-Cola empire.
Okay.
And had a huge farm near Ooltewah, Tennessee. And he talked to Summerfield about allowing the American Chestnut Foundation to have an experimental orchard there to grow American chestnut trees and weed out the ones that were susceptible to the blight and try to help find more blight-resistant trees. And so Summerfield donated first one orchard, a piece for one orchard, and then another one. And I think possibly there may be three orchards out there
now. There might be. I've been out there before, but it's been a couple months, and it was just once. I didn't learn. I think there are, yeah, there are definitely two. I think there might be
three. I think there may be three now. And so then Mr. Rowell really wanted to try to increase the genetic pool of trees. So he would call people and interview people all over the Southeast, and wherever someone had a chestnut tree that was an American chestnut tree and he could prove it was, he would go and try to get sprouts and bring them back here. And
did he do this like himself?
Yes. Yes, and he was, like I said, he was in his 70s. He built, or had someone build, he called it the chestnut sled. And it looked sort of like an old dog sled that had two long poles, and he had a piece of canvas between them. And I think he had a strap on it, and he would go, literally go into the woods with people And here's a man in his 70s and dig those sprouts and drag them out of the woods and bring them back to Chattanooga and try to keep them alive long enough to bloom so that they could get pollen to pollinate some of the trees that were by then at Bendabout. And he was a fascinating guy. He loved what he did, and he told me one time that he hoped he lived long enough to see the restoration of the American chestnut tree complete, and he didn't. He got sick and died before that happened. But he was probably the number one reason that the American Chestnut Foundation has its presence in Chattanooga now, and that Dr. Craddock teaches at UTC and does what he does.
So how old was he when you're talking about when he was in the 70s? Was that the 90s? Was that the 80s?
That would have been probably early to mid 90s.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say
so
early.
He would have been born in the 20s?
Probably so.
Did you ever hear him say, or why did he care so much about this?
That's a good question, and no, I did. I don't know. I don't know if he had boyhood memories, or if his family told him about. I don't know. I really don't know what got him going, but he was really a driving force in gathering information and getting, he knew how to get things done. He knew how to get people together and get things started. And he would have meetings and bring people in and have them talk. He was just very good at that. And you couldn't resist him. When Mr. Rao called, you couldn't say no. He was just that kind of guy.
Yeah.
That you loved anything he wanted, you just wanted to do it for him.
Did he have any other passions? Like, was he sort of a naturalist kind of guy? Like,
he was a naturalist sort of guy. He was an outdoors person, and I think he helped to start and Dr. Craddock would know this, but I think he helped to start the rowing program at GPS or at UTC, and I think he actually built the first rowing house on the river down there for them.
Yeah, this Rowell Center.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you're right about that.
Yeah. So he was an avid outdoorsman and probably... And he was a naturalist, too, because at that time, well, I still have them, but I had some pink lady slippers and yellow lady slippers and trilliums at my place, and someone told him, and so he just showed up one day with a couple of his buddies. They were out driving around, and he wanted to see the lady slippers, and we went, and I showed him the lady slippers, and the guys couldn't believe it. They'd never seen them. You know, they'd heard about them, but never seen them.
I think I've seen people like down in Shake Rag at Suwannee. They've got Shake Rag Holiday. It's got, like, really amazing wildflowers.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've seen it.
So, yes, he loved the outdoors and loved wildflowers. And I think he was also involved with reflection writing. You might be able to talk to some people at Reflection Writing, like Bill Crutchfield, William Crutchfield.
Okay.
Bill knew William very well, and they were neighbors on the mountain, and he would be able to give you more information about Mr. Rowell's interest. But he was a fascinating guy, and I still miss him.
Sounds really amazing.
He was. I still miss him. I was talking to my wife the other day, and I still wish I could talk to him.
Do you have are there any other stories that jump out at you?
Yes, here's another Mr. Rao story.
Okay,
great. One of the first orchards was at Lula Lake. I don't know if you've been to Lula Lake or not.
But I really want to get up there.
That was one of the first orchards, and it was sort of ill-planned, I think, because what they did not do was provide a good water source. And one of the things that I think the foundation has learned is how important water is to get those chestnuts up and going, especially since we've been in drought we've been having a drought here for years. And they were planted on the side of a hill, on the top of a mountain, and they didn't do so well. But in wandering around Lula Lake, someone, I think it may have been Bill Crutchfield, in fact, mm-hmm. discovered a Native American chestnut tree that was a pretty good size. It was probably 30, 40 feet tall, probably 8 to 10 inches in diameter. And so he and Mr. Ryle started monitoring the tree, and it bloomed in 1993, and there were some other trees there that also bloomed, and so it was pollinated, and it was loaded with chestnuts. Well, in 1993, Mr. Ryle took his wife to Italy during the time that the chestnuts would be getting ripe. And he asked if I would be willing to go in there and harvest the chestnuts. Well, another thing that happened while he was in Italy was we had a hurricane, Hurricane Opal. It was came through here and dumped about 8 inches of rain. And it washed the bridge out that led to the chestnut tree at Lula Lake. But once you tell Mr. Ryle that you will do something, you have to do it. you can't not do it when he's counting on you. So I hiked in an alternate route about 5 miles in and 5 miles out to get to that chestnut tree and got probably 30 to 40 nuts and stored them in the peat moss in the refrigerator till he got back, and then I gave them to him. And then I think he brought them to UTC, and they sprouted them and planted them. And then I planted three or four at my place, and one or two is still living. One died last year from the blight, and another one has had partial dieback. But we were able to get, 1 year, one of them did bloom, and we were able to get some pollen and pollinate some of the trees at Bendabout.
Oh, great. So that's a 15-year-old tree. That's
yeah.
Good.
Yeah. And so that's always a story I remember about Mr. Rowell, you know, going in and getting the hiking in after the storm had washed the bridge out. No one could believe that much water went through the stream at Lula Lake and into across the waterfall. And the bridge, I think the bridge is still out in the middle of Lula Lake somewhere. I haven't seen it, and they've rebuilt it much stronger and bigger now, but that's my chestnut story from Lula Lake, is when Opal came through and washed the bridge out, and I had to hike in.
Got another one there?
I think I mentioned to you earlier, we still have chestnut sprouts that come up on our property. And in fact, I'm watching two now. However, they will get about 3 or 4 years old, maybe 8 to 10 feet high, and they die and they don't come back. And I don't know if that has something to do with the drought, or if these sprouts have been coming back for so many years that they've just finally are giving up. I don't know, but we still find them from time to time. I have two maybe 200 yards from my house that I'm watching now to see, and they're looking good now. And Dr. Craddock says I should cut the trees down around them, but my wife won't let me do that at this point. But they are still there.
That's great.
Now, you did say, I think before we started recording, that you were trying to find out how people feel about the restoration project, if it's a good idea or not a good idea. I've thought a lot about that because, you know, we're expending a tremendous amount of resources, mm-hmm. which people are donating. I mean, which is wonderful. We're raising a lot of money now. And I think it is a good idea, partly because the chestnut blight is also affecting the red oak trees. In fact, the red oak trees at my place are just dying almost like the chestnut tree did. And the ones that aren't dying have the swollen area around the base of the tree, and they will die because they rot all the way up. Another tree that's being affected is the sourwood tree, and I don't know if it's a chestnut blight or not that is affecting it, but it dies back more readily than it did at one time. So I think it's important to try to restore the chestnut tree, partly because we don't know what other diseases are going to come through and destroy the hemlocks, for example. Mm-hmm. Hemlocks have the mite, or it's not a mite, it's
adelgid.
Yes, yeah. that is on Lookout Mountain now, and we on our place there's an area of hemlocks that are just gorgeous trees. They're huge mm-hmm. trees, and I hate to see them die. And the red oaks are dying, and the sourwoods keep coming back up. But I think it's important to try to do all the restoration we can to try to restore that hardwood forest. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think the chestnut tree was the dominant tree in the forest in the southeast at one point. Mm-hmm. So it may be that it needs to be restored to try to replace some of the other trees that are under assault from, yeah, you know, who knows, global climate change, aphids, mites, you know, all sorts of diseases.
There's a lot up against them, for
there
sure.
There really is. And the other neat thing about the American chestnut tree is I don't think they know yet if it will be the timber tree that it once was, but it's a great renewable resource. It grows fast. And so I think it's very important to try to continue to try to restore it, even though the people who are working hard to restore it now won't live to see what it becomes in 50 or 60 years, which is probably how long it will take before we find out, is it going to have long-term blight resistance, and will it have the same timber characteristics with this Chinese cross that we have, as it did as just a pure American chestnut?
Yeah.
Those are questions that we won't know for years, but I think it's worth the effort. I really do.
That's what I think is so amazing, that, yeah, people are, like, dedicating their lives and this energy, mm-hmm, to something that, mm-hmm, yeah, they probably won't even be able to see, nor do they really know if it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing I've been curious about is, well, why do you think people have been willing to put that kind of effort and energy into the American chestnut tree over some other kind of tree? I know that there's a lot of, like, talk and effort right now about the hemlock, but there's tons of trees and all kinds of species that have gone extinct for this or that reason. It seems like the chestnut's been unique in that it's this private effort, and it's been a real consistent effort and widespread, too. And I'm wondering, what do you think it is about the chestnut that people have been wanting to rally behind it in the ways that they have?
That's a good question. I think there are a lot of different reasons. I think a lot of people have nostalgic memories of things that they've read about it, and because it was called the redwood of the East. It was an incredible timber resource, food resource, and I think a lot of people feel some nostalgia for that and would like to see it restored. The other thing about the American chestnut tree was it as a nut tree, it bears every year, whereas oak trees usually bear every other year. But the chestnut tree consistently bears great crops, or it did when it was in its prime, which fed deer, bear, squirrels, turkey. That whole population collapsed when the American chestnut tree died. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a lot of people who are interested in restoring some of the original beauty that was this country before we cut it all down to build houses and, you know, just and have timber. And with the land trust movement is growing. And I think probably those two, the people that support land trust because they want to see that habitat restored and wildlife restored, are the same kinds of people that want to see the American chestnut tree restored because it offers such promise, both food for the wildlife that we're trying to save and to restore, and for people as well, and for timber. So I think there are a lot of different motives.
Yeah. Of the people who are in the Chestnut Foundation, do you think, so there are all these different uses, but are the people who are involved in the Chestnut Foundation, do you think, are they foresters? Are they, plant pathology people interested in disease? Are they agriculture people interested in this food crop? Like, what do you think are some of the more exciting ways the chestnut could be used if it was restored, that are specific to the Chestnut Foundation? Or do you think it's kind of all of the above?
I think it's all of the above. I think there are a lot of professors in universities all over the country who are trying to restore it. There are forestry people who would like to see it restored. Mm-hmm. I think it's all of the above.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All those people are interested in that.
So one question I would ask people is, like, are you involved in the restoration effort at all, and what motivated you to get involved?
I'm not as involved as I once was, simply because I don't have the time, but also partly because the Chestnut Foundation is doing very well now. A lot of volunteers, a lot of money is going into it, and I just have other projects, so I don't feel as needed as maybe I did in the beginning. Mm-hmm. To be a part of that. But I was motivated partly from nostalgia of my grandfather's stories of the chestnut tree, and partly from reading about it. I love trees. I just think they're one of the most gorgeous trees ever. And I spent some time in California in the redwood forest and love those trees. I mean, being in those groves of trees that are 2,000 and 3,000 years old is like a spiritual experience to me. And just thinking about the chestnut tree being that here at one point, I'd love to see it restored. I just think that would be a wonderful thing to bring back to the east, to the southeast and northeast, to have great trees like that to enjoy cutting for timber, eating the nuts, saving for animals, just saving to look at, to let them be a part of the forest. It's just, they belong here, and I'd like to see them brought back.
One thing I was just thinking about, so, and you kind of touched on this a second ago, but so it seems like you've been a part of this chestnut effort for the last, 15 or 20 years in Chattanooga. Have you seen any trends, where is there more effort and energy now than ever before, or has there been more energy and effort, kind of excitement around the whole chestnut restoration project at one particular time?
Oh, I think in the past 5 to 7 years, it has really taken off. Mm-hmm. I think there was some good publicity. Of course, Jimmy Carter's help, he helped to publicize it some, and I think the more people found out about it, they wanted to know about it and then get involved. But I really started noticing about probably six, seven years ago that there was just people were coming out of the woodwork, and money was rolling in and donation and people were donating property and people were volunteering and chapters started springing up. There'd always been a few, but I think they really got up and going within the last 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is because more people who had some knowledge of plant pathology, of what was involved, started getting involved and trying to do what they could, and were providing leadership. Which is what the program needed. It needed more than just the Fred Hebbards who were doing the research. It needed some promotional people, and I think that happened, and once people found out about it and started studying about it, they're just a lot. And I think we're living in a time when people are worried about what's happening to the planet. And the chestnut tree restoration was one small way they could get involved in trying to restore something magnificent that had been lost.
Yeah, I think that is interesting and true, too. I was going to say, so do you think that the restoration effort will be successful?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have no doubt that it will be successful. What I don't know is what the long-term future of the tree will be. But no one knows that. Something else could come along. For example, I have been a hobbyist beekeeper. Well, honeybees are not a native species here. They were brought here by the Europeans. They were wonderful. They spread all over the country. They've made agriculture what it is in this country today. But now they're suffering from so many onslaughts of so many things that I think we almost have to forget honey. We can't forget honeybees, but we have to really concentrate on restoring the native bee population, the solitary bees and the blue bees and the bumblebees and the wasps that do pollination. And in some ways, I feel the same way about the chestnut tree. That is as nice as hybrids are, and honeybees are a hybrid, you know, hybrid of sorts, and we still need to get back to what survived here for 10, 20, 30,000 years, because I think they have a better chance of surviving than the imports, mm-hmm. like the honeybee and like other trees that are nice. And I have some Meta sequoias in my yard, and I love them because they're beautiful. But the American chestnut tree really belongs there, mm-hmm. you know, because it was there long before, it's been here for thousands of years, mm-hmm. you know.
So do you think there's anything wrong with this, with the fact that this chestnut that we're going to be putting back into the forest will be a hybrid?
I don't know if there's anything wrong with it. I think there you do what you have to do to try to restore something sometimes. You know, that's a difficult question to ask. You almost get into moral questions then. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for antibiotics. I'd be dead, you know. So I'm sort of glad for antibiotics. And if it takes hybridizing a chestnut tree with a few extra genes to try to give it some resistance, I'm all for that.
Yeah, that is sort of like a more philosophical question, but it's interesting to see how people respond to that. So another thing I've been asking people is, so we have this sense of why the chestnut was important like 100, 150 years ago. People ate them, people fed their hogs chestnuts, people built things out of chestnut, all that kind of stuff. So how, like knowing what the role of the chestnut was in the past, how might the role of chestnut be similar or different in the 21st century, or whenever it is finally restored? Will it fill those same roles it did originally, or will it have a different sort of role, or how will it be?
No, I haven't thought that much about that, yeah. But I think it could be a great timber source again. Part of it is because it's a beautiful wood, and once you see chestnut lumber, you never forget it. It's unique. My wife was an artist at one point and doesn't have the time now, but at one point she painted gourds. She did folk art paintings on gourds, and we would travel around and do craft shows. And we went to Bell Buckle, Tennessee, mm-hmm. several years ago, and we stayed in the home of one of the organizers of the Bell Buckle show. And I walked in their house, and we were looking around, and I walked out in the backyard, and he had an old barn in the backyard. And I thought, that looks like chestnut. And I walked over, and it was. The whole barn was made out of chestnut wood. And I went back, and I said, do you know what that barn's made from? And he said, no. He had no idea that it was chestnut. And so I told him what it was, and he said, well, I know the stuff never rots. You know, just a few boards around the bottom had some rotten places, and it had been there for who knows how long. And so I think it could be a great timber source again. And it's a beautiful wood. It was used in furniture. Mm-hmm. You know, it was used for shingles on people's houses. It was used for siding. It was used for so many things. It was used for posts because it's so rot resistant. Mm-hmm. I think it could be a wonderful source of timber, and we're going to continue to need timber. It's a renewable resource that we need. And it's fast growing, and I think it is important to provide food for wildlife. That's just, you know, I just think they need to have a fighting chance, and the chestnut tree is one of those things that provides food for so many kinds of wildlife. You know, it's just amazing when you think about everything that ate chestnuts.
Yeah.
So I'd love to see it restored for its timber value and for its wildlife food value and for commercial use as well.
Mm-hmm. What about, and this is like harder to put in words or express, but it seems like the chestnut had this, or it was like a cultural symbol in some ways, that it was symbolic of this lifestyle, this like mountain rural lifestyle, mm-hmm. that people people lived, and it was an important part of their life. So, and obviously people aren't going to be, you know, roasting chestnuts over the fire to eat whenever, but how do you think it could have sort of that, some kind of cultural role or be symbolic culturally for the South, for the Appalachian region, upon restoration? And do you think that would be similar or different?
I don't know. That's another good question, and I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just in the South. It was all the way up into New York.
Right.
In fact, that's where the that's where the blight started, is in the New York Botanical Garden, I think, or somewhere up there. So it was the redwood of the East. I think I mentioned that. And I don't know about having some kind of cultural status now. I don't know. I think a lot of the nostalgia now comes from the people who you would like to interview who are gone now, but who've left some of those stories with their children and their grandchildren. So I don't know that it will ever have the same, iconic value, I guess is the right word, as it did then, because it was such an integral part of people's lives. I mean, they used it for everything. But we're not an agricultural society anymore. You know, just agriculture is such a small part, or the people involved are such a small percentage of the population. But I don't know if it could ever become that or not. But it'd be nice to think that it could, simply because it's such a majestic tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the American Chestnut Foundation, as you said before, is very unique in its role of just deciding we want to restore this one tree. So it may be that, you know, with the right PR agent, it could happen. Everything's PR and money now, it seems. I think if it were done right, then, you know, everyone would want one in their front yard, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it will be harder to get younger people, or just thinking about the fact that if you may not see the chestnut restored in your lifetime, I may not see it restored in my lifetime. So who's going to kind of carry the torch, so to speak? And yeah, who are these people going to be who are, you know, carrying the torch in the future? And why do you think they will want to be a part of this restoration?
I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know. I think I told you in the beginning, I'm 58 years old. And the older I get, the less I know, you know. But one of the things that I have observed is that things happen that you can't predict and cause people to take an interest in something. And it's like the American Chestnut Foundation. Just a few people got started, and it was just a small group, and they struggled and struggled for how many years trying to get going, and now they're doing great. And culture changes, people change, young people, your generation has a whole different way of looking at things than my generation did, and the generation that follows you will.
Yeah.
And there will be some, I sort of think there will be some in each generation that take an interest in natural things. Although my wife and I often talk about what technology has done to young people who spend so much time on a computer instead of time in the backyard or in the woods or fishing or hunting or hiking or camping. You know, 30 years ago, that was a big deal. Now, if you do take the family camping, they take their cell phones and their computers and their video games, and, you know, you have to sleep in an air-conditioned comfort, and so there's not the interest in the natural world that there was before, and we worry about that. But I still believe that there are enough people out there that will take an interest in it and find each other,
mm-hmm.
and keep it going. And maybe in 30 years it won't matter. Maybe the chestnut tree will be doing so well on its own with the efforts of the people who are alive today that it won't, that it can just, you know, we gave it its jump start, you know. And it's antibiotic to cure it of its disease, mm-hmm. and it will be okay. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you think that these stories about how chestnut used to be used and why it's important are? Do you think it's important to record them, or do you think that those could play a role in motivating people in the future to get involved?
Oh, absolutely! I absolutely do. I think that the more stories like this you can record, and especially if you can find older people who would be in their late 70s to late 80s now that had more memories of it, I think it's great to record them, because you never know who will read that book. You know, it's fascinating to me who will just happen to read that story and get interested. You know, I just happened to pick up a National Geographic, read the article, and it reminded me of stories that my grandfather told. And when he told them to me, I didn't take any real interest in the chestnut tree. But when I read the story of the restoration, it kind of sparked something. I said, I'd like to be a part of that. And I think recording stories, because you don't is important, because you don't know what's going to happen down the road, and it's nice to have them. I'm sure you've heard of the Foxfire series of books.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that in some of those books are some stories about chestnuts.
There are.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I need to dig through those. I haven't done yet, but I know that there is some stuff there. The last question I have is just, do you have any concerns, hopes, or fears about the restoration process right now? Any advice you would give to Chestnut Foundation, or any sort of comments?
I haven't really thought a lot about that. I think any time an organization reaches a point that it has where it is very close to getting the tree restored to a blight-resistant tree, then the organization has to decide, where do we go from here?
Mm-hmm.
Do we continue to try to promote the chestnut tree and all of its uses, or do we say we did what we set out to do and now we can disband? As you know, most organizations can't disband. There are too many vested interests at this point, and there's too much money involved and too many livelihoods. But I think that the American Chestnut Foundation and the board of directors, and I'm sure they are struggling with, when we reach this point, number one, how do we distribute these nuts? Do we become a for-profit organization and sell them? Or do we give them to other people? And then what do we do? You know, what do we do with all the time and energy and the knowledge that we have gained over these years? Do we just continue to meet and talk about what we've accomplished, or do we set new goals and decide, you know, what do we want to do now? You know, is there something else that we can do to help to, you know, once the restoration is complete, and I think they're getting very close to that,
mm-hmm.
then how do we get them out there? I mean, there are millions of acres that need to be replanted and can be replanted with chestnut trees. So how do you get that done? And how do you find the volunteers who will do that? And it's one thing when you're trying to reach a goal, the goal of restoration. A lot of people are involved in that. Once you reach that, how do you keep them motivated long enough to get the nuts and the trees spread over a large area, which, you know, it was huge. It's the southeast and the northeast. It's a huge area. I'm sure they're dealing with those things, but I guess those are my two main concerns. Where does it go once that happens? And I think their goal will pretty well be met within the next 5 to 10 years. I think it will, from everything I've read and heard.
Yeah, I've heard a few people say that. So for the last 20 years, there's been all this energy put into doing this blight-resistant seed, back cross, and then now we're at this point where we have it, but yeah, the new question is, how are we going to distribute
mm-hmm.
it out?
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to be a lot of like private landowners, a lot of communities
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
are going to have to buy into it a little bit, plant the
right.
seeds, make sure they don't, you know, clear some trees around
right.
it and all this stuff. And will people want to do that? It's going to be hard to get a lot of people said no, it's not going to be difficult to get people to do that, because there's plenty of people, there's plenty of reasons to do it. There's wildlife mm-hmm. reasons. There's the timber and the nuts themselves. But yeah, I think that will be really interesting. Why is it? Yeah, just how difficult will it be to get people involved? Because that's going to be really important. It seems
mm-hmm.
like.
It'll be vital to get it spread. And I don't think there'll be a problem with that, because I think one of the things that the American Chestnut Foundation has done very well in the past few years is to get their PR machine going. And it's going to really need to kick into gear when they get ready to distribute the nuts.
Mm-hmm.
But first they have to decide how to do that. So those are internal struggles that the foundation and the board have to struggle with. But it's going to take a lot of a promotional promotion to do that. And that may be a new way to spend some of the money that comes in, just to let people know what is available and what they need to do, and
mm-hmm.
and make films about what you can do in your own backyard and distribute them to chapters and to schools and that sort of thing, which
mm-hmm.
is not something that's being done now. But there are a lot of ways to do it. And I think they're almost at the point where they can start turning some of their energy toward how are we going to get the word out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think colleges, where the research is being done now, high schools, forestry departments, I think there are a lot of avenues, but somebody's going to have to be in charge of that. It's like Mr. Rowell in Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
If it hadn't been for him, none of what's going on in Chattanooga would have ever happened. It takes someone who was willing to step out, take some risk, get embarrassed, do some stupid things a few times, and learn, but have a desire to really let people know about the tree and that it's available. Here's how you do it. Here's where you can plant it. And people like leaders. If you find a good leader, people like to follow them. So. And the American chestnut tree, I think, has a lot of good leadership material. So I'm very optimistic. I'm an eternal optimist. I'm concerned about global climate change. Who knows how that will affect a young tree that's just trying to make a comeback? No one knows,
mm-hmm.
But we have to keep trying, I just feel like we have to keep trying to find ways to provide food for ourselves, for wildlife. Timber for ourselves. We'll still need wood. Wood is such a versatile material. We'll still need it. It's a great timber source. So I'm optimistic. I don't know how we'll get things done, but we'll find a way. The human race, above all, is very innovative. A lot of ingenuity,
mm-hmm.
and just look at what has been done with the American chestnut, and the millions of hours that went into. To research, and they've done it. They're doing it, and it will happen.
Yeah. That was great. That was really great. That's pretty much all my questions. What I have been doing with people, maybe I'll just run through these, and you've pretty much told me some of this stuff already, but maybe it'll jog some memory you have, and you'll have some story, I don't know. But what I've been doing is asking people about selling and trading chestnuts, which you mentioned, your dad saying that you remember people selling them, eating chestnuts. How are they anything about how they were prepared?
I hardly ever eat chestnuts.
Yeah.
In fact, most of the chestnuts we've eaten were at Dr. Craddock's house. And I like them. I just love the idea of the tree. I think it's more the idea of this majestic tree that I love.
Mm-hmm.
The practical part, the nuts, is I love the practical side of it, but I think part of what I like so much about it is just the majesty of the tree itself, just the idea of this majestic tree being restored.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I bet a lot of people feel that way too. It's not about it being a timber source or having this or that economic reason or whatever. It's just about... Or just about trying to bring something back.
I think that's part of something that was lost that was so incredibly important to early American. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would be interesting to see or have someone go back and try to reconstruct what would have happened to the early American pioneer if it weren't for chestnuts. You know, because they literally lived off the land. Mm-hmm. They were self-sustaining farmers. And what would have happened, how would they have made it if it weren't for the chestnut tree? Because they use those chestnuts year-round, you know, mm-hmm. for flour, for food, in commerce, they sold them. It's an amazing story. It's been fun to just to sort of be a part of it on the sidelines and observe it and read about it. Mm-hmm. Talking to people that are involved in it. They're fascinating people, rich, poor, educated, uneducated. They're all wonderful people to talk with. And it's like there's no, with the American Chestnut Foundation, there is no class. You know, there is no rich, there is no poor, there is no educated, uneducated. It's just everybody's in it together, working toward the same goal. And it's sort of a neat concept.
It is really neat. Yeah, that's great. So you've asked people about harvesting and storing nuts. You mentioned your dad got them in the sacks. Did you ever say anything? Did they ever store them up in the house, or was it more?
He never talked about that. I think they probably ate them, but then sold the rest because mm-hmm. they were desperately poor, and so anything they could do to sell them, mm-hmm. just to make some money, they would do. And my guess is that from what he told me, they were used mainly for fattening the hogs, which you then, you know, slaughtered and salted and cured, and you had food throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And then sold the rest of them.
Did your dad ever say anything about like building anything with chestnuts or any lumbering practice? Did he ever?
He didn't talk about that. And he actually had a little sawmill when I was a boy, but I don't remember him ever talking about sawmilling chestnut.
Okay. Were there any like traditions or games or anything like that? Do you remember any sayings, songs?
No, I don't remember any of that.
Did your dad ever tell you anything about what it was like? Oh, you mentioned this not on tape, I think. You talked about what do you remember your dad saying? Or maybe this is, I've talked to so many people about chestnuts, I get it on this. So many talk about how their dad remembering their dad being really upset about the blight. Do you remember your dad saying anything about the blight? Or
no, that was the interesting thing. That's very interesting to look back on that, because when I took that chestnut, or I got off the school bus and told him about eating the chestnut, he told me the story then of growing up. But it was a blight that killed everything. But I can't remember him expressing a sense of remorse or sadness or any of that. And you know, it's interesting because some people had just, you know, they were just devastated with the loss of the trees, but he never said anything about that. And I don't, you know, that's interesting that you asked that question, because he never expressed how painful it was to watch these trees die off. And maybe he was so young at the time, he would have been in his 20s, maybe 20s, 30s, that he just didn't realize what was happening until it was already done. But he never said anything about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think that the loss of chestnut had any like direct economic effect on him and his family? Or
yes, I'm sure it did. My grandfather was one that I couldn't get him to talk much about his past, and I remember when Alex Haley's Roots came out, and I was in my teens at the time, and I wanted him to tell me about his roots and his parents and grandparents. And he said, I never wanted to know much about my ancestors. I was always afraid I'd find a horse thief back there somewhere, and that's about all he ever told me. And he just, you know, he never really talked that much about that sort of thing. He just didn't. He's one of those people that didn't talk.
Yeah. My dad would say that my granddad was like that too, his father, because he grew up in Indiana, and I think his parents owned a funeral parlor, and mm-hmm. my dad was saying how he always felt like his dad was not ashamed of it, but like not proud of that, and just didn't like to.
Wasn't something you talked about.
Yeah, it wasn't something right. that he wanted to share a bunch mm-hmm. of us. I was kind of curious. That's about it, though. I've gone through all these questions. Is there anything else you want to add, or?
You've pulled more out of me than I knew was there.
Good. That means I'm doing something right. Well, thank you so much.